Session number 12989.
Mr. Finnegan, Riedel 2. Sir, to start off with, you were to carry the Bren gun equipment ashore.
And plus explosives. I carried approximately 25 pounds of explosives ashore as well.
And where were you supposed to put all that stuff?
Well, as soon as we got onto the beach, we knew that we would have to discard all our equipment, and most of us had to discard our weapons because we were back into the water to remove all the mines that were on all the tetrahedrals. That is the obstacles that were in the water, and also that we couldn't take arms into the minefield itself. The chaps who carried the metal detectors ashore, we found that it was quite useless using those for the simple reason that there was so much shrapnel around that as soon as you switch your detector on, you just picked up noise. So we had to do the old-fashioned way of prodding for the mines. The object of clearing all these minefields was that we wanted the fields for de-waterproofing the armour that was coming ashore that day, and they had to have an area, a marshalling area, where all the de-waterproofing was carried out. The only vehicles that came ashore were really the small vehicles, like the jeeps and things like that, which quite a lot of them, and ambulances, of course. We had ambulances coming ashore on the first day, but mostly armour that was coming ashore.
So were you satisfied with the briefing that you got?
Oh, yes, yes, excellent. The briefing that we actually got was quite good. And as I said on previously, that the sand tables were very, very large, and you knew when we were going ashore on the D-Day, you could see in front of you the sand table. In actual fact, it was the actual place where we were going to land.
Who was in charge of your company?
We had a major in charge of the company. A captain, and then each platoon had its own lieutenant in charge. Approximately 60, 65 men in each platoon.
And did the men in your company come from all over the country?
Come from all over the country. It was from the very north, up from the Hebrides right down into the Channel Islands. We had personnel. So it covered every part of the country.
And did everybody obey the security arrangements in this
in the transit camp? Yes. As a matter of fact, before the transit camps were closed at various times when we were going on exercises, they were closed at various times. They removed, although there was a lot of civilians in the same area, they removed all the ladies who were pregnant. They were moved out of the area, and children going to school still carried on with their school. The whole area itself was guarded by the Royal Artillery, our particular camp, because for the simple reason that the Royal Artillery weren't required for the first 3 or 4 weeks, because we could use the Navy. The Royal Navy was our own artillery.
How long were you at Chandler's Ford?
Chandler's Ford, I should say we were there approximately 6 weeks. But we did a couple of exercises. We used to have our money changed into various currencies, what they called BAFs at the time. We have our money changed into these various BAFs. One particular time it was Dutch, another time it was French. And then, of course, French again.
So that's British Armed Forces currency?
Yes, forces currency that we could spend.
Did the troops get fed up of being at Chandler's Ford, waiting for the big day?
Not really. We had a lot of entertainment. We had rather large marquees with 24 hours a day film shows. They were on all the time. And the films that we saw were before they were released to the general public. They came straight over from America. And I think I saw going my way about 12 times, I should imagine, with Bing Crosby. That was on 24 hours a day for the whole week, Then they changed. They had several tents with, you know, different films going on. But that was one film that I can always remember and that I always liked.
Did any VIPs come round to give you pep talks?
Yes, we had a pep talk from Field Marshal Montgomery. We had a parade for Winston Churchill and also for His Majesty the King.
Did you get into the frame of mind where you thought, well, I might not come back or I might get maimed?
No, that thing never entered my head. It was one of these things that it's never going to happen to me. Some of the chaps thought that way, but I can't, as I can recollect, I never did.
Did they say that to you?
Yes, there was one or two who said that they didn't think that they would come back. Fortunately, they did. But there was one that he had a saying that roll on death. And he got killed the day after D-Day in the minefield just off the beach.
Was he in your unit?
Yes, he was in my platoon, yes. He was in the next section to me. I was in number one section and he commanded number two. He was a corporal. And that was one of his favourite sayings.
Did he say it in a jocular way? Or?
I don't know. It was just one of those things that he used to bring into the conversation. You know, oh, roll on death. And that was it.
How old was he?
I should say he was about 30 years of age.
Can you tell me what happened after the 6 weeks at Chandler's Ford were up?
Well, when they were up, yes, we got, we were sent down to we didn't know it was going to be that particular exercise that was going to come out to be the real thing. What happened was that we paraded on the road again from the tannoy that said that our serial number had to parade on the road, and we went onto the road and we had to be when we travelled in these trucks, by the way, they were personnel carrying trucks, carried about 30 men. We had to be very, very quiet. And also the back was down so that if the truck went along the road, it looked as if there was nothing, no one inside. We had to be quiet and we went to Southampton into the docks and got on board ship, and that was on June the 1st. Which was nearly a week before D-Day, and then moved out and went behind the Isle of Wight.
What happened there?
We spent a couple of days behind the Isle of Wight, and they let us off onto a beach. They pulled up onto the beach, and we got off there and played football. But before we could do that, there was a unit that was completely penned us in, sort of thing. They were all armed. We weren't allowed off the beach, and they made sure of that, so we could kick a ball around on the sand. And that was like all our, that was our exercise.
Did you realise this was the big thing?
At that time, no. When we got back on after the on June the 4th, we went out. And we knew it was going to be the real thing, and of course we came back on June the 5th, because as you know the D-Day was put off for one day, and because of the weather, it was quite wild. The weather, it was a lot of green faces around, and then we came back, but of course we didn't land. We're still offshore. And we knew exactly that we were told that that was the real thing, but it had been cancelled for 24 hours. And then on the 25th, we set sail again, and we landed early in the morning of the 6th.
What happened on the voyage?
Chaps were being sick, and we were still we were cleaning our arms. We had a lot of Canadians on board ship who were cleaning their arms and also sharpening their knives. You've got to realise that a lot of these Canadians brothers of chaps who had been killed at Dieppe, and they were quite mad, I should think, that they were all looking forward to this landing, and they really wanted to revenge what happened at Dieppe.
Did you eat food on the journey?
Oh yes, yes, we carry on eating food. It was there was no galley on board, but we could manage to heat our tins of food up. We had the compo that we could use. Yeah, we didn't go short of food at all.
Did anybody use any alcohol or drugs?
No alcohol. I don't remember anyone having alcohol. And of course, drugs at that time, I don't think were invented, I should imagine. But they did exist, of course, because everyone had a file in their pocket on their battle dress, you know, but that was morphine. That was because if anyone had a serious injury. But that was the only drugs that we had, which we had to carry anyway. But as regards the things that you get nowadays, no, nothing like that.
Were there any vehicles in the LCI?
No vehicles at all. No, it's purely infantry.
Where were you on this craft, at the front or the back?
On the front. On the front, going in, we got hit. Going in, and we lost one of our ramps. It's there are only narrow ramps that you went down, like a gangway. We lost the starboard one, and that blew some of us down. So we had to be helped to be picked up. And we all got off the port side.
What do you think hit you?
Another craft hit us with a bang. The skipper we had was a Canadian, and he said that the trip was a one-off trip. He had to get us ashore. Didn't matter if he got back, because he fully expected to have the bottom of the ship blown off with these tetrahedrals.
What do you remember about the collision?
Very little. It was just that the ship that's going in alongside was blown off course by an explosion, and he just collided with us. I don't think it caused any damage at all, except that it tore one of our ramps away.
Did water come in?
No. We were all up on deck, so it wouldn't have mattered anyway, because we were all up on deck, just in case the bottom of the ship had blown out with the mines that were on these obstacles. Because you didn't know, you couldn't get between one or the other. It was quite narrow. The only things that could get between them was the LCIs themselves, the small ones that carried about 30 men. And they came from their mother ships, so like scrambling down the nets and then coming ashore that way, like you see nowadays with the Royal Marine Commandos. That was the type of ships that we had, or the type of landing craft. There was no vehicles. They came ashore later on during the day.
How far offshore did the collision take place?
Oh, quite near the shore. It was less than 100 yards. Less than 100 yards from touchdown, sort of thing. Very near. It was high tide at the time, and you could just see the tops of these obstacles. But you knew that every obstacle carried its mine. It carried a mine, which was intended to rip out the bottom of a landing craft. There was telemines, which was like an anti-tank mine, covered in tar for keeping it from being corroded by the seawater.
How deep was the water?
When we landed, 4'6". And that was when the wave was down at its lowest, and when it went up to about 6 foot. So most of us were swamped, but there were a couple of sailors there that used to try and help you. We did lose one. We did lose a chap that got swept away. That was in another craft, that was in another unit, that he was never seen again. But we did have a chap in my unit, but in another platoon, who was picked up by a Canadian. A Canadian was twice his size, and he just helped him up, sort of thing. But it was quite deep. It was very, very deep. A lot deeper than what we were used to on our exercises.
Did it make much difference to the equipment you were carrying?
No, because as soon as we got on, as I said before, as soon as we got on shore, then all your equipment was discarded. That was left on the beach, and then you went on to your various tasks that you had to do.
Do you remember being under fire as you...
Oh, we was under fire all the time, yes. We was under heavy fire all the time. The assault infantry that was on our ship, they were going ashore and they were going straight through the minefield. They looked as if they never had a care in the world. And they were very lucky, as a matter of fact, because the minefields were a mixture of anti-tank and anti-personnel. The job I had was to accompany my troop commander, or platoon commander as it was then, on a reconnaissance to find other marshalling areas. And the only way that we could get off the beach was to hitch a lift on the back of an Inzif Corps regiment recce car, a reconnaissance vehicle, which was armoured. And we had to climb on the back of this and hold on. The corporal in charge of the vehicle said that he would not stop. It was a matter of getting off the beach up to a little crossroad, approximately 200 yards in distance. And he said he wouldn't stop, but he would slow down. And as he slowed down, would we kindly jump off and then go our own way? And he would go the other way. But before he could slow down, we were blown off. He was hit twice with anti-tank, and unfortunately that was the end of the armoured car, and also the driver and the corporal of the armoured car. Myself and my subaltern, we were in a ditch and we were all right. We just got blown off with the blast. Being on the back of the vehicle and not on the top, we probably got away with it.
So no injuries to you?
No injuries to us at all, no.
How did you know it was an Inzif Corps recce car?
Well, I knew that after when the Inzif Corps brought more vehicles ashore. Now, they were a part of Bing Force. Now, Bing Force was a reconnaissance unit that had to go in very, very fast for about 25 miles and blow up certain bridges so that the enemy couldn't bring any tanks up to the beachhead. Their vehicles had no Allied markings on. They were painted black, the same colours as the German vehicles. They had a lot of sappers with them. That was the object of taking these sappers to these bridges, quite a long way inland for the first day, to blow up the bridges. But unfortunately, that failed, owing to what they call nowadays friendly fire. The American Air Force managed to beat them up quite heavily. They didn't carry out any objectives, and on their way back, they were also hit by the Canadian armour.
How soon after landing were you blown off the recce car?
Oh, matter of minutes. That was my first job, was to accompany the platoon commander off the beach and to recce further places where they could bring vehicles ashore and de-waterproof.
So once you'd been blown off it, what did you do then?
We just carried on. We carried on with the job that we had to do. And it was a matter of 3 or 4 hours later when we came back. This armoured car was still stuck in the middle of the road. It was still burning fiercely, but you could see that the remains of the corporal and the driver were in the vehicle.
What do you remember happening to you next?
Well, the next thing I knew that we were just carrying on in the minefields, picking up mines, searching for the mines, disarming them. And then what we used to do, we had Pioneer Corps people with us, and they used to pick up, after we disarmed these mines, they would take them back along the beach and we would blow them up in situ, possibly about 20 at a time, so that there was these explosions going on, but that was away from the people who were landing actually on the beach. It was quite a distance from them, and we used to get rid of the mines that way by blowing them up several times during the day. There was quite a lot of minefielders there, quite a lot.
How did you find the mines?
Prodding, and once you got the pattern of a minefield, it made it quite easy.
You mean the pattern in which they'd been laid?
The Germans were very methodical on that sort of thing, and they used to lay these in very, very good patterns. And once you found that pattern, then it was quite easy. That made your job a lot easier. You knew that there's probably three or four paces between each mine, so your prodding then was a lot easier. And you just went forward in lines, carrying at least, you had these white tapes that you used to carry behind you, so that you cleared an area possibly 3 or 4 foot wide. Then you had another sapper by the side of you doing the same. So in the end, you know, you get half a dozen sappers and you've got 50 or 60 feet that you were clearing at any one time.
But didn't the Germans stick one in irregularly every now and again?
No, they didn't do that. No, they were very methodical. And we never did find the German... When you lay a minefield, you have to write down, because you, at some time you might have to pick it up yourself. So when you did your own pattern, then it had to be very, very accurate. And you had to write that down, it had to go down on paper. It had to be very accurate, just in case that you had to pick up your own mines. And they were actually doing the same thing.
What did you probe with?
The end of a bayonet, you know, sort of in a bayonet. The bayonets that we had were the little, like what we call pig stickers, you know, sort of thing. They were very, very small, probably 8 inches long, little round things at a point on the end. That was with the Mark IV rifle.
Couldn't you set the mine off by probing it?
No, because what happens is that when you probe at an angle and not a direct push. An anti-tank, you could walk on an anti-tank and it wouldn't go up. You'd probably have to have 300-pound pressure before it would do. But with an anti-personnel mine, then you're talking of about 5-pound pressure. Now, the majority of anti-personnel mines that we found were what they call S mines. And the only thing that was sticking out of the ground was three little steel prongs. And they looked like a little blade of grass. That's all it looked like. And once you found that, it was quite simple to remove it. You must have realised that these mines had been down for a couple of years, so you knew that there was no mines that were booby-trapped. Otherwise, the wire of the booby-trap would have rotted through, sort of thing. It wouldn't have been any good. So we knew that there was no booby traps on minefields that had been laid for a considerable time. And we used to take these S mines out. Now, if you trod on an S mine, that what happened with that jumped out of the ground and exploded approximately 4 foot above ground. And there's about 350 bore bearings in that, and they just scattered all over the place. We lost three chaps on the second day with one of the S mines. They were going in to try and recover a flail. A flail is a tank with the chains on the front, and that had got knocked out, and the crew was still inside, and we decided to send a small team in. And unfortunately, one of the sappers, or we assumed one of the sappers, trod on an S mine, and then that killed the three of them. They were quite close together, and that was it. The injuries are all in the head, from the shoulders up.
So most of the mines you were removing were S mines rather than...
S mines and telemines, and also French, a lot of French anti-tank mines. On other beaches, of course, there was British mines. When we pulled out of Dunkirk, all the stores that were left behind, they used those to a great advantage. So it was British mines and everything. But when we pushed forward, of course, the mines were a different type of thing altogether, because the mines then were booby-trapped, because they were being pushed back and they were laying mines that were booby-trapped.